You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodores Mananan, Jawbreaker, Kruger, Loining, MD, Charles, Logan, The Knight of Dampier, Pablo, Toves, Gin-Soaked Jim, Workman, Legends, Kinway, Two-Gun Tony, Drunken Dak, Eric the Red, Redbeard, The Pirate Nopales, Hefe, Matthew the Navigator, Bull, Vertigon, Jennings, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. In 1689, after more than a decade away from home and years in foreign seas, William Dampier was aboard an English ship anchored in the Moluccas. He received word that his old friend and shipmate, the ship's doctor on board Signet, Herman Coppinger, was aboard another ship in the harbor. Dampier took a boat over. The last time Dampier had seen Herman Coppinger, the surgeon was being forcefully detained by the Signet pirates. That was while Dampier was preparing to abandon the ship. The ship Dampier approached was flying a Danish flag, and when he pulled up alongside, every Dane on board had, quote, a gun in his hand. Soon enough, though, Coppinger came to the rail and saw Dampier. He told everyone to stand down. Coppinger had his own odyssey to tell, including capture by Malacca pirates. However, once they discovered he was a doctor, they made use of his services, and in thanks, they dropped him off at a Portuguese outpost. There, Coppinger was taken on by this Danish ship to serve as a doctor on their return to Europe. Now that's all fascinating, but Coppinger had other news to share, big news. The King of England, James II, had been deposed. He didn't have many details. The Danes had only just learned of it before leaving, but reportedly, James' eldest daughter, Mary, sat the throne. Dampier was understandably surprised by the news, but this was three or four pieces of news all at once. Likely, he didn't even know that Charles II had died and that James was, for a few years, king. The last reliable news he received was probably in Virginia in 1683. Now, I love these kinds of stories, that moment when people who have been far from home for years hear news that changes their world. You know, there were French fur traders that came out of the wilds of Louisiana only to learn that their king had been executed and France was in the hands of the people. There were American pioneers and settlers that didn't hear about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln for months or maybe even a couple of years. This is something that we've lost in the modern world. You know, we know about all of the big events, sometimes while they're actively happening. With the advent of radio and TV and, of course, the internet, we all get our current events currently. That gives everyone the opportunity to react in real time, which usually means sharing their opinions, which I think we can all agree is the worst, even when we're busy slamming away on our own keyboards. But news traveled a little differently in the early modern world. It took months following the Glorious Revolution for English and Scottish men and women to hear the news, and they did so in waves. The news was followed by, well, the emotions differed. In some circles you would find joy and jubilation and people toasting the revolution, but in others you would find shock and despair, disbelief and anger. The revolution happened so fast, though, that nobody had an opportunity to react before it happened. Once the cat was out of the bag, well, they have the same inclinations we all do. They wanted to share their opinions, but without the internet, they had to do so much more directly. This is episode 166, Jacobites. I suppose we should start with the definition. What was a Jacobite? If you look deeply enough, it can become a complicated question. But on the surface, a Jacobite was simply a person who supported the restoration of James Stuart. The name James is derived from the Latin Jacobus, hence Jacobites. But even the name is controversial. The word began as a pejorative. They used the Latin name in an attempt to remind people that Catholic James was linked, as well as his supporters, to Rome. But it failed as a piece of propaganda, kind of like that faction in the ancient Roman Republic that were dubbed Optimates by their enemies. Some Jacobites adopted the name. They threw it back in their enemies' faces. In that respect, the link to Rome, it can be indicative of their ideology. Or some of their ideologies. Jacobites weren't unified at all in their philosophy. If they'd had a uniformity in their thought, as much as they had a uniformity of purpose, they maybe could have won. But of course, they're not going to win. Now, I've debated how much time to spend on each of these individual Jacobite ideologies. I had a whole episode about it, but I didn't like it. It's totally unrelated to piracy and really not that interesting. Instead, I'm just going to break the Jacobites down into three main groups, broadly speaking. First, you have the Catholics. As James was the last Catholic king of England, he was supported by most, but not all, Catholics in the British Isles. That means mainly a lot of Irish people. This was not the origin of the, I'm not really sure what word is strong enough, the tension. It's not the origin of the tension between the English and the Irish people, but it would be a source of continued tension for years to come. Then the second group were, if we were to leave theological and ideological concerns out of it, they were the Scots. The House of Stuart, of course, came from Scotland. They had a lot of support from Stuart loyalists and members of their family in their homeland. That was, in fact, my introduction to Jacobitism. Kind of. In the Liam Neeson movie Rob Roy, there's a bad guy nobleman that whispers of his rival in the region being a Jacobite. Gasp! But that's decades later, in the mid-1700s. The third group, though, are more difficult. They have no easy national distinction. They come from everywhere in Europe. The thing that ties them together, really that ties all Jacobites together on some level, is a belief in the divine right of kings. They believed that in the overthrow of James II, God would smite all of England into damnation for dethroning his chosen king. At least that's what those factions would say. May not have been the case in truth. See, a lot of that group are foreign. A lot of French and Spanish and German and Danish, basically from everywhere. The question is, though, were they honest actors worried about English souls, or were they cynical actors? Those who intended to work against their nation's official policy for personal gain. Probably a bit of both. In every soldier and in every army. We're going to spend a good deal of time on that question in the weeks to come, but I want to begin today with James II. Is it even appropriate to call him James II after the Revolution? James Stuart and his wife, Mary of Modena, along with their infant son, James Francis Edward Stuart, and a few other notables, fled London in the face of William's invasion. James sent his family on to France, but he stayed in England to attempt to raise an army. However, the soldiers just weren't there. There were too many nobles and far too many officers, and too many soldiers that were unwilling to raise arms against Mary, who had until very recently been their expected heir. So James gave up his quest for now, then he prepared to board a ship for France, but inevitably he was captured. The greatest sin of James II, a sin he shared with his brother and his father, was arrogance. They had a belief that they were actually ordained by God. I don't believe that, but I do recognize that there are many people in the world who still revere the Stuarts and the Habsburgs, and they do so from a place of genuine religious faith. But if James was chosen by God to be king, he failed in his mission. It's like that joke about the guy who was trapped on his roof during a flood. He prays to God that he would be saved. And a few minutes later, a log floats by, and he thinks, "No, no, God will save me." Then a guy in a canoe comes by to rescue him. Again, "No, God will save me." Finally, a helicopter shows up. "No, God will save me." And of course, he drowns, and when he gets to heaven, he asks God, "Why didn't you save me?" And God says, "I sent a log and a canoe and a helicopter. What else do you want from me?" James, well, he could have saved his reign. The former Lord High Admiral had one of the best navies in the world. They lived on an island. But he failed to employ them. And James wasn't stupid. Militarily especially, he was quite talented. But he failed to use those skills. When he tried to flee England, James could have escaped. But he would have had to take steps that he was not willing to, not to be noticed. He marched boldly to his ship. However, though he was captured, as anyone could have guessed, he might have been right. Conventional wisdom would expect James to be imprisoned or executed, but that's not what happened. Mary realized that executing her father, or even just imprisoning him, was not only uncalled for, but it was a dangerous move politically. So William and Mary let James go. He sailed on to France, free. And he stayed there for a while, but he began to receive correspondence while in France. Most of it came from his supporters on the continent, those foreign people we mentioned who could arguably be called Jacobites. He began receiving letters from British and Irish people as well, supporters mostly, but more interesting were the letters he received from men who had, just a few months earlier, plotted to see him overthrown. They weren't exactly throwing their support behind him, and they weren't even apologizing usually, but they were explaining their position. They were downplaying their role. They were trying to save their hides just in case James should win. There were a number of these, high-profile names, too. James' one-time chief minister, the Earl of Sunderland, for example. But in the interest of continuity, I'm going to focus on John Churchill, who we talked about last time. After James fled England, the new monarchs, William and Mary, held their official coronation. As is tradition, and as is practical, they began to ennoble those who had served them on their way to the crowns. John Churchill was created the Earl of Marlborough. He was also added to the Privy Council and made a Knight of the Bedchamber. These were huge honors. Churchill, though, Marlborough, properly at this point, he was still something of an outsider, in every circle. The Jacobites, and I'm going to call them the Jacobites, but that's not really accurate yet, but it describes supporters of the deposed king. The Jacobites saw this cavalcade of honors coming Marlborough's way, and they grew to despise him. They saw him as a turncloak. But William, despite all of these honors, didn't trust Marlborough either. He was a well-known favorite of James. He was in James' camp, literally in his military camp, when William was already on English soil. Now, of course, Marlborough organized the invasion, and he abandoned James' camp very publicly, and that may have saved his life. But really, it's his wife's friendship with the queen's little sister that earned him his place at court. Anne pushed for Marlborough to be on the Privy Council. However, it was his own military accomplishments and Marlborough's popularity with the army that earned him such a high role in the military. Now, he wasn't in the highest of positions, and in fact, some of this it's hard to say what's truth and what was later amended by Marlborough, but he says that he was one of the highest military officers that actually handled military affairs. His immediate superiors were flatterers and courtiers to King William.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Of course, to his credit, King William was a commander-in-chief that actually did the job. In 1690, he personally sailed off to Ireland, and he took most of those courtiers with him. He did so because James Stuart arrived at the head of a French army to rally the Irish Jacobites, but we'll get to that. First, though, this was a huge boon to Marlborough. When William left London, he left Marlborough in charge of the army in England. Now, I'm not sure if it was his status as a less than trustworthy commander, or if it was a show of faith on the part of the king. Maybe it was a test of his faithfulness, but Marlborough made the most of his new office. The Master General of the Ordnance was a position of great honor and great responsibility in the English army. It was disbanded in 2013 and handed over to a civilian office, but it was a hugely important position in the 20th century. The Master General of the Ordnance oversaw the artillery, but in the time of two world wars and the nuclear age, artillery was a big deal. Now, Marlborough was not the Master General of the Ordnance. Not yet, at least, but his immediate superior was. However, that man was one of those courtiers we mentioned. The word flunky is often bandied about with his name. King William loved all of the things kings are supposed to love, like horses and swords and knights and duels. So he kind of ignored the artillery. But he also loved winning battles, so he gave Churchill a very long leash in procuring arms for England. The Earl of Marlborough took that power and began to reform the army into something that we would see as almost modern. The pike formations guarding slow-moving, slow-loading, slow-firing musketeers, they were on their way out. Marlborough's first big advancement was to order thousands of flintlock muskets. Now, this is going to be huge when we get to the war, but of course, the flintlock is a giant in the story of piracy. If you had a pirate gun, a toy pirate gun, growing up, I guarantee it was a flintlock. Before this time, they were still using matchlocks that had a lit bunt that snapped down to fire the powder. They weren't great on land, but they were terrible at sea. The bunts went out all the time. The flintlock looks extremely modern. It has a metal hammer that strikes a piece of flint to create a spark to light the powder. It's so much better at sea, it's incalculable. And thanks to Marlborough's massive order of thousands of these fantastic guns, they began to filter into private hands. In part, that was the black market and battlefield scavengers, but now that they had been forced to design new flintlock muskets, many of the manufacturers produced these better, cheaper guns in mass. Before long, they were the standard small arm. From this point on, we can picture the pirates almost exclusively using flintlock muskets, as well as the English army. The British army's focus on things like rate of fire, the tactics that would conquer the world in the British Empire, well, they began here. Perhaps even more important and less talked about was Marlborough's focus on speed and mobility. He built legions of what looked very much like French dragoons, maybe thanks to Turenne's influence here. That means they rode horses. Now, they weren't cavalry, they just rode horses to and from the battle, but that means they were able to arrive on the scene and choose their location before the enemy. Then, given their lack of armor and fast firing capability, they could dominate a battlefield. It was a revolution in military affairs. For a moment here, and this will come into play later, the Royal Navy had flintlock muskets, but the private naval mercenaries that ruled the seas did not. It gave the Navy a huge advantage and really dampened piracy for several years. But back to Ireland. James Stewart landed on the 12th of March 1689 with 6,000 French troops at his back. This was the opening move in what is called the Williamite War, or the Williamite-Jacobite War. But if you pull back and look at the bigger picture, this was merely a move in the 9 Years' War, as was the Glorious Revolution. But this move in Ireland was an outflanking maneuver. The fight that was coming may have been a fight between two rival English kings on Irish soil. But it also wasn't. It was a fight between the Prince of Orange of the Netherlands and the King of France. Make no mistake here, without King Louis's support, James Stewart would never have been able to mount a force. And Louis certainly would not have spent the resources on this invasion if it were not militarily advantageous. See, the war was already well underway. We've focused on the Glorious Revolution, but while that was happening, on the continent, France was on the move. Keep in mind, though, that the 9 Years' War is... that's a later name for the conflict. Nobody at the time thought it would be a 9 Years' War. They all said it would be a quick war. That's what they said about every conflict. But at first, Louis fought it as just another semi-annual campaign to capture land in Flanders. It looked very much like parts of the Franco-Dutch War and the War of the Reunions. Louis's armies marched on fortress cities in the contested land west of the Rhine. They bombarded the walls and besieged the people until they eventually capitulated and handed their flag to France. This was an old style of war. William, though, rather than send his armies south to fight the same war again, he sailed for England. He cut off the British Isles from Louis's camp. It was a massive coup in the war. It could also be argued that in doing so, William extended the war to come, turned it into the 9 Years' War. He opened up a whole new front in the fighting. This was not going to be yet another campaign of bombarding fortress cities. It would start off that way, but it was going to turn into so much more. The Williamite-Jacobite War in Ireland, the actual fighting, I mean, isn't super important to our story. It culminated at the Battle of the Boyne River. The two sides, the English side led by William and the Irish-French force led by James, they drew up on either side of the river, each of them on hillsides leading down to the Boyne River at the bottom of the valley. They each hoped that the other side would attempt to push the river, to cross and charge. They would have been able to fire down with impunity on anyone who did so, but of course, nobody did so. Instead, they sat on their respective sides of the river and fired at one another with their big guns, occasionally maybe striking the army on the other side. The Protestant Williamites, though, did wind up winning the day. There was an irregular cavalry regiment. By irregular, we mean, of course, not formally trained. They were recruited from the militias around the area. That means that they knew the land, though. They rode down river to an out-of-view, out-of-the-way river crossing. Then they flanked the forces of James and came up behind the Jacobites. Unexpected, they crashed into their forces. And once James was forced to turn around and deal with that, William ordered his men across the river, and they were surrounded. James and the French broke and fled. They ran back to France. The Irish would feel betrayed by this for years to come, but for now, the battle was over. Of course, the fighting in the Williamite War would continue for many years. As it happens, it would be under the direct command of the Earl of Marlborough in the years to come, his first direct military command. But that's an Irish Jacobite rebellion, not necessarily a theater of the 9 Years' War. The biggest consequence of this conflict was the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland. The influence that the Battle of the Boyne and the Williamite War would have on Irish independence movements is difficult to calculate. But everybody knew immediately that the tide had turned. From the moment that the battle ended up until today, it's been a part of the Irish experience, and not necessarily a happy part. The 11th and 12th of July are celebrated to this very day by North Irish Protestants. On 11th night, they burn huge bonfires, and on the 12th, they march the route that William took to the Battle of the Boyne to, once and for all, defeat what they see as the Irish people. These marches are led by a fraternal Protestant order there in Northern Ireland called the Orange Order, after King William. Of course, they can't actually get to the battlefield. The Battle of the Boyne happened in what is today the Republic of Ireland. They're not about to let a bunch of drunken orangist Protestants into their country to cause a ruckus, and along their route in Northern Ireland there have been clashes in recent years. It's still a tense situation. Throughout the 20th century and the rebellion in 1916 up until the Troubles, the Battle of the Boyne was always a firebrand of an issue. This is all fascinating stuff in the story of Irish independence, but it's not a pirate story. Next time, though, we are returning to a pirate's tale. We're going to travel back across the Atlantic to North America. There we're going to examine the American Jacobite reaction to the Revolution. and we're going to talk about one of the very few famous Jacobite pirates, Thomas Pound. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, everybody who has signed up to become a patron on Patreon, anyone who has left us a rating or a review wherever you listen to the show, everybody who has donated through the website, and everybody who has recommended this show to your friends and family, online or in real life. All of you make it possible. Thank you. Our theme music was, as usual, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, you absolutely should do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com. As always, most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.